And Lloyd and I tried very hard to create a good domestic scene for the kids. We did a lot with friends of international students. We invited anybody who wanted to come for Thanksgiving, and we got an Egyptian couple and some other kind of Arab man, and whom I don't remember distinctly, but the wife of the Egyptian couple became close to me, and she used to come out, and we'd cook together, and she taught me to do Egyptian dishes, and we had a very good time, and she was so happy because she was very isolated and lonely, and her English was a little halting, and she said I was like her sisters at home, that they could cook together, and it made her feel good, and it was, so we did things that seemed, you know, cozy, family-ish, but actually we were relating as little as possible except around the children. And Jacques by then was in kindergarten and had to get on a school bus, and I had to walk him up to the highway every morning at 7 o'clock because he was the first child picked up because he was the beginning of the route. And we would stand on that busy highway, whatever it is, 14, mm-hmm. I think, that goes past Middleton, mm-hmm. trucks roaring past, and cold as the Dickens all winter, and put this little tad on the school bus, and he had to ride for an hour each way. He was the first child picked up and the last child delivered at noon from kindergarten. But he had a marvelous teacher who was actually the wife of my beloved geology professor in college, Loudon, and she was crazy about Jacques and he about her, so I guess it was worth all the school bus stuff. But it taught me that it's very difficult to live in the country with children. I took the cure on that. I had some notions about that being a good thing, but transportation was horrible. And so there we were, and Lloyd got his, he didn't quite have his PhD, but we just were too poor. We just couldn't sustain it anymore, so it was time to go to work again. And Lloyd got a job with Science Research Associates in Chicago. And I started having nightmares. Oh, the Cuban Missile Crisis was going on, too, to add a little zest to everything. We were living in terror that we were going to have nuclear war at any moment. I used to listen to the trucks roaring past on the highway at night as I was sleeping, trying to sleep in the farmhouse, and imagine that they were missiles coming over. Because we were all, the whole populace was just terrified. And then the Kennedy confrontation, of course, and we got through it, but it added an element of something. I suppose it's what the English experienced during the Blitz. It was, because I was very unused to living in mortal terror, but I did, and a lot of people did. I was not alone in that. So it was a year of very heightened emotions. And then I was terrified of Chicago, because my image of Chicago was what you see driving through it or around it. And I don't like large cities, and I saw it as being difficult to have the kids in the right situation, and me having friends that would sustain me, and I knew I would be a housewife then for sure. And we started looking at houses as far away from Chicago as we could get, mostly because of me, and Lloyd said he was willing to commute. We ended up in St. Charles, giving Lloyd a 55-mile commute. He thought he would ride the train, but then he found out he wasn't good at being one of the boys playing cards on the train, so he drove the car off every day. So I was out in St. Charles with three little kids and no car. But once again, women sustained my life, not in a lesbian sense, but next door turned up a firefighter's wife named Carolyn, who had, I think, also four little kids or five little kids. They were Catholic. And the kids were of like age and congenial, and I enjoyed Carolyn. She was just a good, easy neighbor, and we had nice exchange, you know, the usual stuff, recipes and birthday parties. And Lloyd suddenly had an attack of getting religion, which was odd. He was a recovering Catholic, and I was essentially agnostic, and I just didn't have much interest, and started going to an Episcopal church and taking Jacques and Michelle. It's really weird. He'd dress them up. He even had Michelle wearing hats and skirts, and they'd go to church. And one Sunday, he came home from church, I never went, and said, "You would really like Michelle's Sunday school teacher. I told her to come calling on you." And I said, "Oh, fine, just what I need in my life, a Sunday school teacher. Thank you very much." And but I acquiesced, and one day up the walk came this bouncy little redhead wearing very strange cowboy boots. And she came up to the front door and said she was Nancy, and she was Shelley's Sunday school teacher, but she said, "I would just love to meet you because you sound like fun." And we became the greatest of friends for the whole year that I was in St. Charles. I just loved Nancy Rompel, and she loved me. She had six boys, count them, six, under the age of 12. All of them but one, red-haired, Lance somehow came out with dark hair. And right after I left, she had a seventh child. They gave her a pink shower, and she had a seventh boy. She was married to an alcoholic, a former parachute jumper who had gotten injured jumping and was lame and somewhat handicapped and couldn't handle it and just drank his way through everything. So she had but he had a job. He had good connections. Nancy just kept hatching these boy children. She's a great mother, just great. I remember I was self-conscious about our house because we had attic furniture and rattan and cheap area rugs and it was just kind of makeshift graduate student kind of furniture. And I laughed at myself when Nancy invited me to her house because their furniture was all up on bricks because the boys wrestled so much they broke the legs off of everything. And she was pretty unapologetic. She just said, this is the way. And that first visit, I'd made tea and cookies. I mean, it was ridiculous. I thought that's what you did with a Sunday school teacher. So she's clumping up in these cowboy boots, and she says, excuse the shoes. I couldn't find mine, and these are Lance's cowboy boots. And I was just delighted, just delighted. And she was a great reader, and we had a lot of books in common, and she loved, loved, loved to read to her kids, and she was very excited that I'd had experience as a children's librarian. And we had a great year together, picnicking, and Lloyd became almost irrelevant. He was gone anyway all day, and he was no fun when he got home at night. We usually fought. We drank and fought. Nancy and I drank, too. We drank wine, but we didn't. The kids had to come home from school, so we usually stayed pretty compos mentis during that period of time. And so that was a very sustaining thing, even though I wasn't having an intimate lesbian relationship. I was heavily involved emotionally and just in fun. She was a great playmate, Nancy was, just a great playmate, and we just had a terrific year. And another friend, an old friend from graduate school, well, her husband was in the history department, actually, came and made an extended visit with her two boys, and we loaded everybody up in coaster wagons and went down to the island between St. Charles and Geneva and had a picnic, and we had a lot of just fun times, and I wasn't working for the first time, and I wasn't in graduate school, and I wasn't even taking a correspondence course. It was just great, so... But I was noticing this emerging theme of women friends sustaining me through this, and marriage, parenthood being really, really significant for me and, in all fairness, for Lloyd. But marriage being an also-ran, it was just not an institution I cared for. And alcohol being a growing factor, although I wasn't really recognizing it then. I was in a lot of denial. It was just part of the fun and part of the relief and one way to get through this tedious marriage thing. And so, well, after a year and making money and accumulating a little, Lloyd decided that it was time to go back and finish his degree. So we embarked on yet another. He found an old farmhouse in... Madison, and we embarked on another year of voluntary poverty. Only I only worked sporadically. I had like a summer library job because with three little kids it was getting tricky. And we had animals. We had poodles and cats. And in those days you didn't spay them, and we had kittens galore, and it was a very interesting household. And at one point Lloyd knew he'd have to work the next year and he'd have his degree, so he was doing job interviews, and he interviewed in Champaign, Illinois for a superintendency and felt that the interview went so well that he thought he was probably going to get the job. And so we had intercourse, with unprotected intercourse, yeah. And that was the beginning of Blaze. We thought if it was a girl we might name her Champaign, but it didn't turn out that way. our youngest son, now 45. And so we were living in this farmhouse with pregnant Jane, voluntary poverty. He didn't get the job in Champaign, needless to say, and did however, finish up his degree. I typed his, no computers in those days, I typed his dissertation and edited it in the backyard, largely on a card table, with Chris Tide. We didn't have a fenced-in yard, and he was an escape artist, and Blaze sleeping beside me. And we got it, and he passed. He took his orals, and he passed, and he had his PhD, but it was quite a year. We had a Southern-originated neighbor over the back fence named Ms. Moe. She called herself Moe. She was Moore, M-O-O-R-E. But I remember her looking over the fence one day and said, Jane, if I had your life, I'd go crazy. Little kids all over the place and poodles and kittens. And I said, Ms. Moe, I think I have. But something incredible happened that year. Betty Friedan came to town. Mm-hmm. I just clipped a picture of her from the calendar, and I got to put it up someplace because she changed my life, Linda. She cast the perspective I just needed on all this traditional women crap, on the Ladies' Home Journal Good Housekeeping way of life that I had not been able to tolerate. And I was having fun being the mother in the old farmhouse on Regent Street and with all these little kids, but there was never anything conventional housewife about it. I belonged to a church discussion group. I didn't go to the church, but I went to the discussion group that had a group of very, very bright women suspended in situations like I was. They were being housewives temporarily and then would go on and, you know, get their PhDs or the Nobel Prize or something. They're terrific women, and we had just marvelous discussions and read really interesting books and explored Zen Buddhism and meditated, and it was terrific. And all of that stuff was very heady, and a great company of women, just a great company. And one of those women, then named Elthea Steideman, started becoming a friend more than in the class, but we had to move away again, because when Lloyd got his PhD, he ended up in another job where he ended up, I'm having trouble with the chronology here, ended up working for IBM. Well, I know he went back to SRA and they got absorbed into IBM, so he became an IBM employee. And they knew he was good at curriculum. Oh, shoot, I forgot a whole era. He got a job at MATC as head of the General Studies Department and did a marvelous job with that. He got the college parallel course developed that they have now and took it through accreditation. He was brilliant at that, too. He was a very brilliant man. He still is, probably, but he's a disgusting brilliant man. But anyway, I don't like him very much. But anyway, he was very good at stuff. And so when IBM absorbed him, they assigned him to develop a new curriculum in a Job Corps center out in New Bedford, Massachusetts. And he went out house hunting, found a place for us to live temporarily, and it was challenging. We had four kids, two dogs, two cats who had just had 13 kittens between them. They were very young kittens. And then he found a place to live temporarily, stayed with his boss and his wife briefly while house hunting, and took Jacques and Michelle with him, and he took both dogs, leaving me with the cats and the two little children to sell the house. We lived in this creaky, funny, eccentric, delightful little farmhouse on Regent Street, which we had paid $16,000 for, and very small mortgage payments. And so my job was to somehow, out of this chaos, make a saleable house. I remember that I cleaned closets every day, and it was a nightmare because the boys couldn't even find their shoes most of the time. I mean, it was just really hectic. Blaze was not quite three, and Chris was a kindergartner, and oh man, it was really something. So we managed to sell the house to another graduate student and get our money out of it. And I gave the last kitten to the moving man, last kittens. I placed all of them except maybe three or four, but his mother had a farm and needed some more barn cats, so I gave the last cats to him. They all had fleas that summer. It was one summer where everybody gets fleas, and the house was full of them. And I remember with each kitten, I gave out the last flea treatment, a bag of flea powder, and off they went. So we moved to New Bedford. We ended up in a very posh area called Nonquit, and the only reason we lived there is that it was a summer area. People like the Cabots and the Lodges had summer places in Nonquit, very, very elegant. Well, we had a wonderful old cedar-shaped house that had been expanded and had a big sunroom. It didn't heat terribly well, but it was an all-season house. And they were willing to rent it to us until the summer, because then we would be gone. It was a one-year assignment. Actually, it was supposed to be a few months, but it turned out to be a 10-month assignment. So the kids were in school. So we had an intensely interesting year. For me, it was mostly interesting because the boss's wife became my best friend, Midge. And she had a child Jock's age and a child Blaze's age with nobody in between. And she was stranded out on the edge of this base in a tiny house and had no neighbors except the Job Corps Center itself, and was a graduate of Wellesley and very bright and very funny and very devoted to her children and all-purpose talented and just cute as the Dickens, freckles and back. She's still one of my very best friends. And she would come out almost every day, once Ted got off to work and Lloyd got off to work, Midge would appear with the two boys, and I had the little boys, and Chris wasn't in school yet, and Jock and Michelle would go off by school bus to a school peopled with Portuguese kids. And Midge and I had the most marvelous time. She was very, very heterosexual. In fact, that year she had a torrid affair with her pediatrician, which I rather admired. I thought it was a good idea. Her husband was alcoholic and a wife beater, it turned out. Did a good job with the Job Corps Center, but he was a very difficult man. And Midge was funny about him. She'd get so angry at him, and she said, "You know how I get even with Ted?" And I said, "How?" She said, "I've got a mattress pad that's full of menstrual blood that I don't wash out, and I put it on his side of the bed." I thought that was maybe the pinnacle of passive-aggressive behavior. I just got the biggest kick out of that. I wonder if Midge remembers it. I'll have to tell her next time we email. We email a lot. And so we just had this really fabulous time together. And Lloyd got his job done there before Ted did, and they invited us to live in their house in Evanston when Lloyd was reassigned in Chicago. So we lived in their house for several months. And that was great because everybody fitted, and it felt good, and Midge had done wonderful things to it. And then we found another house that would suit us to rent. It's kind of hard to rent a house in Evanston, we found out. But there was one that was going to be torn down because it was in a block of apartments. They had a system where they had a block of apartments, now condominiums, and then a block where these wonderful old houses were allowed to stay, and then another block of apartments. And the block we were in had apartments on both sides, and this house was doomed. And that was perfect for me because with four kids, no known housekeeping skills, and attic furniture, and three kids in school and one still at home. And then by the time we were there and Midge came back, I persuaded her, who was a very bookish woman, that she needed her own skills developed, her own degree, because she wasn't going to live with Ted forever. It was a nauseating thought. And she decided, with my considerable encouragement, to go to library school. And I kept her youngest son, Seth, with me by day, which was marvelous because he had Blaze all day and Chris half the day to play with, and he was a darling child. I still love Seth, and he was just like one of the family. So we had a remarkably good year in that house, with many trips to Madison, which was still our home base. And but I had neighbors. I had a good friend next door who had lived in Columbia. Her husband worked in foster parents plan and had been there. And been in Hong Kong. They were going to Columbia next, but they had a year in Evanston. And she had boys, and they were compatible, congenial with our kids. And Jacques was in seventh grade and had two really close friends, and one of them was black, which I really liked a lot. He was funny. Tally was a stand-up comedian. I loved his friends. And all of the kids had friends that they brought home. Blaze, of course, had Seth. And on the weekends, we would just be crawling with children, and I just loved it. I felt like everybody's mother, and Midge would come over and be everybody's mother, too. And I remember Midge one day, we were putting a bunch of fish sticks in the oven and counting, and she said, "Jane, we're feeding 11 people." And I said, "Yeah, we do often." She got a kick out of it because she had not lived that way before. And it was my idea of how you live, except that I had Lloyd coming home, and that was always sort of a drag. But anyway, it was fun. And the kids had very good educations. But boy, I did not like Evanston. It was too citified. I felt trapped. The lake, when we arrived there from New Bedford, we had taken a nice trip through eastern Canada. When we arrived in Evanston, the alewives had all just died on the beach. And it stank like the worst of garbage dumpsters. The whole city stank. And then once the alewife thing got resolved, everybody apparently was burning rubber tires in their backyard. It turned out to be soft coal that these apartments burned in those days. So the whole city stank. And you had Lake Michigan here, Chicago here, Skokie, which was a loathsome-looking suburb to me with all of its yellow brick houses, over here, and something very posh, I forget what, Wilmette, I think, north of Evanston. And it was too much Whitefish Bay. It was Whitefish Bay with urban overtones. And it was a dry city, and we had to drive to a liquor store, so I couldn't do it except when Lloyd was home. And I remember the kids, we were all sitting in the car while Lloyd bought liquor, and all of a sudden smoke started coming out of one of the big boxes behind the liquor store next to the parking lot, and we realized someone was living in that box and blowing smoke out, and the kids were just incredibly appalled. Well, a quite wonderful thing happened that year. Lloyd made some money on the stock market. It wasn't a huge sum, but it was a good year. This would have been 1967, 68. And I didn't even know, he was playing very mildly on the market, and but he made like $5,000. And we decided that he would quit his job, and we would take all the kids to Europe for a semester, because we could afford it in those days. And it was a golden opportunity, and he had his PhD, and I had my library master's, and we would be able to get work when we got back, so we weren't going to worry about it. So we did that, and we got real cheap tickets on Air Icelandic, and this was the kind of thing, we could come together on these big, big things, and especially if they involved the children. And we were both very, I was an Anglophile, he was a Francophile, we were very Europe-centered, we'd studied European history and art and theater and literature, and we spoke some French in those days. He was pretty fluent because his mom had been reared in a French-speaking home, and I was doing pretty well with it. We just have, you know, we had that in common, and books with the kids, and that was good. So he quit his job, and we gave up the house that was torn down right after we left, which was a good thing. I didn't have to clean it anymore. I didn't clean it very well anyway. And we stayed with his boss, his old IBM boss on the way out, who turned out to be very compatible. And he and his wife had four kids, and that worked out well. And then we went to New York and stayed with some old friends from graduate school who lived in a high-rise near the UN building. And we were there for Halloween, and the kids just loved it because they did trick-or-treat in the high-rise. Mm-hmm. They were indoors. We'd always had rainy, snowy, sleety ones in Madison, but they had their little costumes, and they all went around from door to door, and it was just great. And then we caught Air Icelandic, and the major adventure on that was that we had a fish dinner at 2 in the morning our time, but we had to go to Reykjavik and do that, so we had our fish meal. The kids thought it was a little strange. We woke them up to eat fish. Mm-hmm. And we landed in Luxembourg, which was the deal with Air Icelandic. But something hideous happened as we were over the North Atlantic. Jacques went into puberty. He was 12. And we had this really nice, fairly compliant, very good student, terrific kid, great friends. We loved everything about Jacques. And he woke up in the morning in Luxembourg and was surly and complaining and defiant and awful. The waiter came and spoke to us first in German, and we looked at a menu that was largely in German and or French. No, I think German in Luxembourg. And Jacques said he could speak English if he wanted to, and that was kind of the attitude with which he went at Europe. It was really interesting, and so what we had there, of course, was an incipient alcoholic, but we also just had a teenager. He became a teenager in that time over the North Atlantic. It was fast work, I'll tell you what. It was horrible. And he ended up running away in four cities where he didn't speak the language and picking fights with kids. He told the Greek boys soccer was a sissy sport. If they were real men, they'd play football. And, oh, he was just awful, awful, awful. Complained. We had a wonderful taverna in Mykonos where they cooked for us every night. I cooked at noon and breakfast, but we were able to go out because it was just $1 a piece. Can you believe a wonderful meal for $6? Mm-hmm. Included after dinner brandy or something. And Jacques wouldn't eat anything but pasta. And the cook, instead of being upset about it, the dad in the taverna saw it as a challenge, and he made Jacques a separate special pasta dish every night while the rest of us ate all the good Greek food, which was quite marvelous. He's a great cook. And Mama in the taverna took a great love for Blaise. She was very motherly, and their only son was off going to school on the mainland because they had great ambitions for him. He was in high school, I think, at the time. And she would take Blaise, little blonde, tow-headed Blaise, onto her lap and feed him like a baby bird. And the other kids would go, they thought it was a disgusting sight. But we had interesting adventures in Europe. Shelley got sick in Paris, ran a high fever, and I thought we were going to do a Madeline thing with a doctor rushing over on his bicycle, but we didn't end up having to call a doctor. She got through it, but it was very, very scary. But we did neat things. We stayed with our friend Jocelyn and her husband and their young, 14, 15 months old. He was still crawling, and I remember that he bit everybody's ankles. My kids weren't too taken with him. We stayed with them for 2 weeks in London, had a marvelous reunion with Jacques and with Jocelyn, and got to know her husband, who started popping beers at about 10 in the morning, which was pretty interesting, and sweated a lot. So it was November, but he kept the windows open, so we nearly froze to death. But we had many wonderful adventures in London. I mostly cook because Jocelyn hadn't quite gotten a handle on it yet. And I remember one night Jocelyn saying, "This simply won't do. I'm supposed to be the hostess here. I will cook tonight. You go off." So we went off to the, I don't know, some art museum, the Tate, I think, and had a good day and came home. And Jocelyn had 7 paper parcels laid out. And she said, "I've bought us wonderful things for dinner." She opened the first one, and it was some kind of smoked fish. And kids were okay with fish. And then she opened the next one, and it was some kind of raw fish. And then she opened the next one, and it was another kind of fish. And then there was a pickled, like pickled herring. And it turned out to be 7 different kinds of fish. And she said, "Oh, I've rather overdone fish, haven't I? But we found some crackers or something, and we had a fish dinner." Memorable fish dinner. She's a great cook now, but I like to tease her about the fish meal that we had. I resumed cooking the next day. It was just too much. They lived in one of those tall, skinny houses with the kitchen down the basement where you spend all your time because it opened onto the garden, and it was relatively warmer than the rest of the house. And then the living room was above that, which nobody ever paid any attention to, and their quarters were above that, and we were up on the top floor. And it was a long way, but it was kind of good, and it was probably the only way they could tolerate guests with 4 children. I don't know, but they were marvelous hosts. And they had a great trick for parking in London. They had an old white van, and they kept boxes in it, and whenever they wanted to go someplace, take us someplace, they would open the rear doors and just pull in any place, the loading zone, and leave the van open. There's nothing to steal. Boxes were empty anyway. And we'd all go wherever, and they never got a ticket, and it was was just great. So that was a good visit. And another highlight, well, we adored Paris. That was just really fun, and it was fun to have the kids there and show them everything, and they really enjoyed it. Although Jacques got mad about something or other and ran away for several hours and worried us greatly because he didn't speak a word of French and he didn't have any money. But he turned up again looking quite satisfied with himself and still irritated with us over who knows what. So, and we went to Rome, which was not a good experience. It was getting very cold. It was late November by then, very end of November, maybe even early December. And when we had disembarked from the train station. We traveled by train from across France and down into Italy. And when we got to the train station, it was totally full of beggars. It was like a ring around all the edges, begging families, mutilated people, people with one limb missing or apparently so. It was hard to tell what was make-believe and what was real, but it looked awful. Big open sores and hands, pathetic hands outstretched. And the children were just hysterical. They could hardly stand it. They had never seen this kind of presentation of what to them appeared to be raw poverty. And they had experienced people sleeping under bridges in Paris, and that had been shocking to them. But this, I mean, it was kind of an amplification of the man in the box in Evanston and then this. And they just went into shock, all 4 of them, just, oh, those poor people, and why can't we help them? And we're so rich, we've got money, and we didn't, of course, have very much. And it was just a traumatic thing. And then the cab driver took us on a long route to the hotel and took a lot of money, which we were not happy about. And we learned later that the hotel was 2 blocks from the railroad station. We could have walked, and that was, you know, so we had a very bad feeling about Rome. Also ate the worst pizza I've ever had in my life in Rome. But in the course of things, we went to the Vatican to see the art. Nobody was Catholic at that point, although Lloyd had a lot of Catholic background. And wouldn't you know, we got there when the Pope was going to appear on his balcony and address the multitudes. So we stood out in the big open area in front of the balcony, and they put out the red carpet showing that the Pope was going to come. And we had Blaise, who was a towhead and really a standout in this crowd of Italians, and we were taller. Lloyd especially was just over 6 feet, and so we were sort of prominent looking with this tow-headed kid and this tall man, and we had Blaze up on some kind of concrete abutment so he could see, and everybody got very excited and started saying "La Papa, the Pope," and kind of cheering, and then silence fell as he actually appeared. And Blaze, who'd been yelling excitedly because he was a joiner, "The Pope, the Pope," turned around in the dead silence and said to us in his shrill little voice, "Who's the Pope?" And everybody in hearing distance just broke up. It was just hilarious. And out came the Pope amidst all this levity and said whatever he said in Italian. I don't know, he wasn't very impressive looking. And so that was our Vatican highlight. Besides the art was Blaze saying, "Who's the Pope?" And that remained a family joke to this day, of course. And then we ended up with this marvelous, I think it was 6 weeks in Mykonos, where we celebrated Epiphany, which they celebrate more than Christmas, and Christmas we did with the American expatriates. But the way we lived on Mykonos was we had interesting days, a lot of time in Vianula's weaving shop. Michelle was learning to weave, and her dad was a weaver, and they had a good connection there. Good times on the harbor on warm days. At that time of year, you'd get wind through the Dardanelles, and it would be bitter cold, and then you'd get wind from Africa, and you'd have summer, and so the kids could wade in the harbor. It was just really weird. And we had rented this little second-story apartment. But at night, after we had dinner in the taverna, I would go home with the kids, and we would read stories, and I would be there, and Lloyd would go out. And it turned out he was going out with men, and largely the gay men of Mykonos. There were a company of gay expatriates and a bunch of Greek men that slept with him, and that was his social milieu. He danced in the tavernas, and he had this whole separate life. And mine was separate, too, but not by choice. I was home with the kids. I was a babysitter. And so this was not a bonding situation. I didn't really mind that he had some nightlife because he was a night person and I wasn't, but I got really lonely for adult company because that was one place I didn't. I mean, I liked Mama in the taverna, but we didn't communicate. I didn't have any Greek and she didn't have much English. And I could say please, thank you, and good morning. It was not, so I felt very isolated and it was difficult. And I took care of that by drinking a lot. I drank a lot of Greek whatever. I didn't like the retsinated wine, the retsina, but I drank a lot of brandy, I think, and stuff. So by the time Lloyd got home at night, I was out of it, and that was a good thing because he was pretty drunk too. His alcoholism was progressing somewhat at that point, I think. So eventually we get home, and guess what? We're jobless, and we lived in a friend's house for a while, but we had to pay rent, and we didn't have immediate jobs. And Lloyd ended up borrowing $2,000 from Mobby to sustain us for a month while he went job hunting, and he did make a connection finally with, of all things, the what's it called, the commodities market in Chicago, which is an association, not really a business, but they needed someone to put on performances, really songs and dances for visiting commodities traders. Board of Trade is the name of it. And so they hired him to do this in Chicago. He would have, one day he might have a whole bunch of Japanese commodities exchange people, and part of his duty was to explain the function of and how it worked in Chicago, and part of it was to just entertain them. And he had a PhD and in theater. They didn't really know it was in theater, but he was good at this, and he did it. And he started picking up some editing with them, and by the time we were about to go under from poverty, he had a full-time job in Chicago. Mm. And our friends were coming back. They were on a sabbatical, the house we were living in up near Hoyt School. The kids went back to Hoyt School, and that was fine. Jock was in middle school by then, but and very, very adolescent. And we found a big house to rent on Regent Street, a big Victorian monster built in 1909 right next to St. Andrew's Church, which Lloyd was enamored of and which I went to this class in. And Big brownstone, 7 bedrooms. Charles Lindbergh spent a summer in one of the bedrooms while he was in school here. That became Jacques' bedroom. And just a great old house, drafty and cold, but really charming, interesting house, eccentric house. It fitted us quite well. And the kids were all launched in school. The younger kids went to Randall School almost across the street, and that was good. And I went back to this class at church, same wonderful women, and Althea Gill, good old Althea. And Lloyd's commuting, coming home on weekends, showing no interest in my week at all. The first thing he would do before he even took his coat off was turn on the TV and immerse himself in it and immerse himself in booze. And then he'd do something with one of the children. If he wanted to go to a movie, he'd invite one of them, not me. And I just developed my own life in this brownstone house. And not what you'd call a healthy marriage. But meanwhile, I was doing this thing at church and started to do separate things with Elf. And we very shortly discovered that we had a very intense physical attraction. I mean, it probably would have glowed in the dark. It was really, really, and we were both restrained about it. She had a companionate sexless marriage to a very pleasant-seeming man who was passive-aggressive as hell. And 3 adopted children, and she was also very into motherhood and a terrific cook and interested in, she was more interested in the domestic arts than I, but really inappropriate. I mean, she looked sort of like a Green Bay Packer. She had a really broad back and shoulders and strong features. She and Peg had a lot in common physically, and I was always half in love with Peg when I was working for her, Peg Moss, who hired me as a school librarian. And one day we were lying on the floor at her house looking at old albums, and suddenly we just looked up at each other and kissed, and boy, was that the beginning of something. I mean, we spent that year raising our families over here, and every available moment when the kids were in school, in bed or doing something together, much of it sex. We had, both of us had built up a real need for that kind of exchange and affection, just affection. And we had a lot of stuff in common. We read the same books in this class, and we had friends in common. And we had a gang of friends who called themselves the Housewives Redemptive Society. And none of us liked to keep house, and we would meet, how often? It had to be more than once a month. It wasn't once a week, probably every 2 weeks, at someone's house, and they would cook a wonderful lunch and direct us. And then we would go to whatever part of the house they were most ashamed of and clean it. We'd clean a basement, and then we'd clean. One time we cleaned a linen closet and found lima beans in it, I remember, which seemed remarkable. And another time we'd clean kitchen cupboards. And we usually got prizes, door prizes, because they would find things that they didn't know they had and give them to us if we wanted them. I got a wonderful wooden ironing board from Julie Soule and made it into, helped the boys make it into a go-kart, I remember, and got a Victorian darning egg from Katie. And we had Kate Ostrander, who was a social worker, later taught in the School of Social Work, and Julie Soule, who was a nurse, and Helen Holt, who was former golf champion and woman and an ardent Methodist who did a lot of just stuff over there but somehow went to this class, and Elth and me. Was there somebody else? I don't know. And we would do this weird cleaning and then eat this marvelous lunch, and then we would drink wine. And our plan was to study the Bible as a piece of literature. And we, for some reason, I don't remember, started with Revelations. And I don't think in all the time we were together we ever got past the first third verse or something, because we always had wine and we got drunk and we started talking about other things, and it was hilarious. Kids would come home from school and we'd send them out to wash the cars or something. You know, it's just wild. But it was great fun. And meanwhile, Elth and I are carrying on this torrid affair, and the house is a shambles, and I was good about the kids. They always had a good meal, and I was interested in their schoolwork and kept track of it. But Jacques became a concern. I went to the theater with a friend one night. They were theoretically old enough to be alone. Michelle was so responsible, it wasn't really worrisome. But I had a call from the police that Jacques had been picked up naked and drunk on Regent Street. He had bought, he was by then, I think, 13, bought a bottle of vodka, but I think it was only a pint, but he drank the whole thing, some kind of bet, I think, stripped off his clothes and ran down Regent Street, and somebody noticed him. So I went to bail him out at a hospital detox, and he was extremely unresponsive to me. He was very hostile and very drunk hostile. And Lloyd was in Chicago, and it was our first experience with what was to become years of Jacques' alcoholism and subsequent drug addiction, on top of whatever normal adolescence is. He had a girlfriend, and they had a lot of sex, too. That was unnerving. She was the child of two gym teachers, but she wore so much makeup, I never learned what her natural features looked like. She had layers of makeup on. She was the ultra femme. Fingernail polish, fingernails out, a yard out. Oh man, that was really something. But they were obviously very involved physically, and I don't know if she drank too, but at one point Jacques ran away from home because he was mad about something or other and lived in Hoyt Park for 4 days. Mm-hmm. And his girlfriend fed him out the back window till we called her parents and asked them not to do that. And he would take the bus down to the downtown Y that was in existence in those days and take showers. And oh, he was just awful. And actually, he was pretty awful till he was 32. But but the fact of having this passionate love affair with Elth and having it be a reciprocal one, and both of us being married sort of, so it had a kind of strange balance. And the kids related pretty well. Her middle kid was kind of difficult and tended to be left out of things. But it went along, and Lloyd would come home on weekends, and that would be a drag, but we'd both get drunk. And I remember one night just getting so drunk I just left him at the house, so mad at him. And I somehow went and stayed at Katie's house, our social worker friend, And Lloyd thought I'd be at Else, and he called over there, and they said they hadn't seen me. They didn't know where I was. He locked all the doors, locked me out. So I just stayed all night at Katie's and went home in the morning and resumed business. But we didn't speak, and Lloyd was good at not speaking for weeks at a time anyway, so that was fine. And but of course we were headed for divorce. And we lived in that brownstone for 1 year, and then Elf and I and my two youngest kids, the boys, and her three boys were on a camping trip down on on the farm. And when we came home, Lloyd was gone, much of the furniture was gone, personal belongings of him, and he had taken Jock and Michelle, and I didn't know where any of them were. I had a sense they'd be in Chicago, but they weren't at that point. He hid them for, I think, 6 weeks, some weeks anyway. Turned out Michelle was very ill during a lot of that time, too. I'm glad I didn't know that at the time. And the priest, Bob Shaw, who had become a friend of mine, even though I didn't go to church, he taught this class and was a participant in it, really. And he appeared at my door and said, "I think you need to start divorce proceedings, Jane. You're in trouble here." And I, "Oh, yeah, I am in trouble." It was horrible. I just felt like Jacques and Michelle, even though Jacques was very difficult, like they were just ripped out of me. It just felt awful, and not knowing where they were. And I had no car, no money, didn't own a house. And Bob was fairly wealthy, and he gave me enough money to get a lawyer and get through the first month until we could get some money flow from Lloyd legally. But in those days, they didn't do much about custody stuff across state lines. It turned out he'd hidden them in Michigan, where he used to work at one point, and then found an apartment in Evanston and moved them there. And Michelle was 13, and she was in that father-loving age, and Jacques didn't care. He thought he'd probably have better access to alcohol and drugs in Evanston, which is true. So they got an apartment in Evanston and started divorce proceedings, which took 2 years because we had a very bitter custody battle. But meanwhile, Elf and I just continued, and not only was it terrific sex and good mixing of kids, because the two younger boys were the ones compatible with her kids. They were like sort of like cousins. They all had a good time together. It was really one big family. And Bob could care less. Another woman, we kidded him about having two wives. And in a sense, he did, because he didn't care for sex anyway, and so that was no problem. And it just didn't bother him. He had to know what was going on, but he didn't care. Probably was relieved, so there were no demands on him. And we traveled together, and we camped together, and we did all kinds of stuff. Just like one big family. And the divorce finally was complete. But, excuse me, during that period, one characteristic of Elf, which I enjoyed thoroughly but didn't really contribute to my well-being, was that she was a winemaker. And a terrible winemaker, actually. It was awful stuff. It didn't taste good. And we would always, I think we were allergic to it, we would both turn bright red, which I don't think is a good thing to do. She made these huge jugs, and she had a lot of it. She had a whole basement full of it. She did once make a good elderberry cordial, but the wine was really, I think it was probably poisonous, but we drank gallons of it. Price was right. Her dad had been an alcoholic. She should have become an alcoholic. She did not. She was bigger. She handled it better. I went from what I'd been doing, which was essentially periodic alcoholism, and through the custody battle and the relationship with my winemaker friend, I became a maintenance alcoholic.
Go.
So we had this big extended family routine, and it was, many aspects of it were pleasant, many were comforting. It was nice during what could have been a very difficult, lonely time, and was pretty hellish in some respects. This custody battle was awful. And I was jobless, which was difficult.
Here we go.
One of the things that Elth and I had in common was a Thursday night gathering that started while I was still married to Lloyd. I mean, he was still ostensibly living in Madison, home only on weekends. Elth was a member of the church choir at St. Andrew's Church, and they rehearsed on Thursday night, and it somehow became the custom of a certain number of the choir people to come over to our old brownstone, a couple doors away from the church, and drink, and have what we thought was a very intellectual, elegant sort of salon. I remember that I had a hostess gown I'd gotten that was Israeli and had grommets all down the sides and was, I thought, very elegant. And we fancied ourselves as Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas, having this elegant. One of the man with a very fine tenor voice was a full professor of English, and another one, he turned out to be my best drinking buddy, because he was an alcoholic too, as it happened. And Katie would come to those, even though she didn't sing in the choir. I don't know quite why. And so we had this gathering of very bright, very interesting, very hard-drinking people every Thursday night. I was always a shambles on Friday, because I wasn't working then either, but it was, and I really had this picture in my mind. This was like Bloomsbury expanded, because this was just, we'd moved to Paris, I think, in my mind by then, and it was, we had this big old house, which was kind of charming in its eccentric way, and, but oh, the drinking. And one person who had a lover singing in the choir would come along. A man named Mike Bemis would come, and his then lover, Reese, sang in the choir, and Mike didn't drink. And he would do things like wave his finger over the alcohol and say, "You'd never have enough for me if I started." And then he talked about being in AA and that he was an alcoholic, and that was fine. He was a very interesting guy, very bright, articulate, fun to have around, rather acerbic, but I enjoyed him, and I loved his drinking partner, Reese, and so it's kind of a mixed group. It was mostly the choir, but they had partners and friends, and as I say, Katie came, I know not why, except it was good drinking occasion, and she was a good drinker. Mm-hmm. And so we had this Thursday night salon, and I developed a closer relationship with Alex. We made an attempt at an affair, but we were always too drunk to consummate it, really. We went to bed one night upstairs after the party, and unfortunately, one of the cats gave birth to kittens on the pillow next to us. That was a hilarious moment. It was not a passionate exchange. Mm-hmm. We were both dead drunk anyway. I can remember it, though, which was kind of fun. I certainly remember the bloody pillow. That's a pretty interesting experience to have in the middle of what's meant to be an affair. That was not a success, but we were great drinking buddies. I remember sitting cross-legged on a little oriental rug we had near the front door and speaking to each other eloquently in Russian, which neither of us really spoke. But we both were very taken with ourselves speaking Russian. You know, it was just so hokey. It was just ridiculous. But at the time, I took it quite seriously. I thought it was a marvelous kind of thing. And what I was doing was lapsing into maintenance alcoholism. And Mike, the alcoholic, recovering alcoholic in the crowd, was keeping an eye on this. And this went on after Lloyd and I split, because I stayed on in that house. The two boys were in the school next door, and we made across the street, and we made a financial arrangement that would sustain it. And I started substituting as a librarian, and I got a full-time temporary, a semester's job at Cherokee Middle School, which was sort of a nightmare, but did that. And so we were, you know, I was making enough living to eke by and still putting in a certain amount of time with Elf. Although, as soon as I got divorce going, our balance shifted, because she was married and had to pay a certain amount of kind of attention to Bob, even though they weren't physically intimate. He was her husband, and she had to defer to a lot of things, and so it became pretty uncomfortable. I would have, you know, run away with Elf and taking the kids or something, I don't know what, but she couldn't do that. There's nothing in her that would do that. We would do things like go out and look at houses that we could buy and have retreats to. It was just idiotic, but we did that. And so that didn't work well. That began to shift. And so I had a horrible, horrible next couple of years, because I became a daily drinker. And actually, it was a three-year situation. Where I was terribly, terribly ill with alcoholism. I had to drink. I passed that hideous line where you wake up in the morning and hope you won't drink and know darn well that you will. And yet I'd have to go to work, usually with a terrible hangover, and I would, all the way home from whatever school I was working at, say, "I won't drink today, I won't drink today, I won't drink today," and then I would go right to the refrigerator where I kept a big bottle of cheap wine and drink it all down gradually over the course of the evening. I drank either a gallon of wine or a quart of hard liquor every day, every night. And I would be sober enough to feed the boys and, you know, maybe read a story and put in a little time with them, and they would retreat to their bedrooms, and I would drink till I passed out, and that was my regimen. Although doing some things with Bob and Elf, going up to their cabin a lot, doing some things with Katie, doing this Thursday night thing, but I had to drink that quota every day. And at some point in there, Mike had the realization that I was really into heavy-duty alcoholism, And he was a pretty casual friend. It wasn't like an intimate thing, but he cared about alcoholism because he'd had a terrible struggle himself. He did a couple of things. He invited me to this dreary little clubhouse downtown to hear his fourth anniversary talk. In those days, when you had a year's recovery, you spoke. And so I went into this smoke-filled room full of dreary old men and their wives and listened to Mike tell his story, which was very enlightening to me and kind of exciting because he grew up in Peru. He was born and grew up in Peru. And he still owed money from all the phone bills because when he got drunk, he called friends in Peru all the time and relatives, and it got pretty expensive in those days. So anyway, it was an interesting story, but I didn't identify. And I remember thinking, when the basket came around, I put $20 in it, which was a huge sum for me, but I thought, these people look like they need help. The crowd was so full of these beat-up old men. There were a lot of World War II vets in AA at the time. This would have been 1973, late in 73, I think. And then Mike addressed it directly. He confronted me, and he said, you are in trouble with alcohol. And I was, by then, suspecting he might be right. I was apparently functional. I got a full-time job at Hoyt School. Bob and Elth helped me buy, and Mobby, who loaned me the rest of the down payment, buy a little house up on Farley Avenue, get out of this big, expensive brick house that I could hardly afford to heat. My last heating bill there was oil. It was $400. I just couldn't do that. So anyway, Mike rounded up another AA woman who was also a librarian, and they invited me down to 511 to talk about their alcoholism, to tell me their experience. And I found the clubhouse as unpleasant looking as I remembered, and there were a bunch of old men sitting around playing cards, and that was not appetizing. And I went upstairs into this dreary room, which ironically looked out over my old sorority house, and these two people told me about their stories. Well, I sort of knew Mike's anyway, and expressed their caring and concern for me. This woman had 12 children besides being a librarian. I was pretty awed by her, very bright, very articulate. No longer living, Cordell, I don't expect you knew her. But I listened attentively and thanked them very much for sharing all of that with me and said, unfortunately, I teach school and I have such a busy schedule and so many meetings. I just don't see how I could fit more meetings in. I just am not going to be able to do that. I mean, it was just kind of a social thank you, no thank you kind of thing. And then I went back down the stairs and passed all these dreary old men and went out. Well, very shortly after that, that must have been in the late winter, early spring of 1974, I had to go, it was April, late April, and very nice out, and was one of many people to go to a dual retirement party. One principal whom I had worked for as a full-time substitute for a year and liked very much about, very, very much, Emery Bainbridge, who was a distant relative even, and my principal at Hoyt School were both retiring, and they were good friends, and they had this huge retirement party of both principals. And I was very nervous about it because I knew they wouldn't have much to drink. There'd be a little wine and beer, and it would be difficult. So I drank about a pint of vodka before I went. So I was in pretty good shape when I got there. I was out on the west side someplace, and greeted a lot of people and blacked out, as I always did. And when I came to, it was 3 a.m. I was lying on dew-soaked grass in the backyard of who knows where on the far west side of town, and sick, sick, sick. And I just didn't have a clue about what had happened at the party, and was full of shame and questions and remorse and hurt all over, and somehow got home, found my car, which mercifully I remembered where it was. There wasn't much choice. They mostly weren't parked on the street, and I was, so I got home to the little house on Farley. And when it was morning and I could decently do it, I called Mike Bemis, and he said, well, I don't deal with drunks. You're drunk. I was very drunk, slurring and vomiting and all sorts of unattractive things. But he said, Reese likes you, so I'll send Reese over and he'll see that you don't die aspirating your vomit or something. And he hung up. So Reese comes to my door, poor old Reese, who doesn't know zip about alcoholism but cares about me, and sat in with me, and it must have been very unpleasant. He held my hand, and I threw up, and I sobbed, and I carried on and said, I've got to do something about this. So he said, when you get sober, talk to Mike. And he kept reassuring me, and talking about hope and talking about how it could be okay. And I just felt absolutely awful. It was a real clear-cut bottom. I felt absolutely dreadful. And about myself and about life, I was suicidal, only I couldn't commit suicide because my boys weren't grown yet. I had a very, very strong sense of responsibility to get them through to adulthood, and then I could die. But I couldn't do it until then, no matter how bad it got. So Mike told me about a clubhouse, about a meeting at the clubhouse I was familiar with, which was not a cheering prospect, and said there was a beginner's meeting on Monday night, and this was Sunday that Reese was sitting in with me, and I should go to that meeting and listen up, and then I'd hopefully get through this thing. So I didn't drink that Sunday, which was April 29th, and my sobriety date, and I went to this meeting the next night, went up those same stairs into that same room, and there was a circle of old men who were wrinkly and had withered up tattoos. They were mostly World War II vets and hideous looking clothing, a lot of polyester. And I think there was one woman in the room who looked as bad as they did. And this is sort of, despite Mike and Cordell and somehow knowing better, these were real alcoholics, and this is what I expected. I would be spending a lot of time with people like this. And my heart just sank. And it sank even further, which was probably through the floor, when one of the old men picked up a book and started having a meeting, and they did announcements that meant nothing to me. And then he started reading out of this thing called The 12 and 12, and it was not a literary masterpiece by any means, and he had a learning disability. And it was torture. It was absolute torture. And I thought, oh, good, I have to pay some kind of penance, and this is it. I have to listen to learning disabled people read this ghastly material and sit with these old men, and if it takes that to get sober, I guess. But then this wonderful thing happened as the men talked after we got through that ghastly reading experience, which I didn't record at all. I have no idea what part of the 12 and 12 it was. But each of these men started talking about their lives, and I identified with everything. Now, these guys had gone as far down as you can go without dying. They were, I didn't know it at the time, but they were living on the Mendota grounds. They were Skid Row bums. They'd all been absolutely, they had no families left, no jobs, no cars, no anything. They had their pair of polyester pants and a shirt and free meals and a place to live, and that was what they had. But they each spoke, he might say proudly, I'm 2 months sober today. And another one might say, I made it 3 months this time. I thought, God, I tried once to not drink, and I'd made it for 3 days and almost died of withdrawal. So I was just absolutely awestruck by these guys. And they began to assume personalities. They weren't just wrinkly old men. They were guys who, some of them would have been colleagues. You know, I could really, some of them could have been my father. Some of them could have been my drunken Uncle Dick. They were interesting to me, and they just had very tough lives. And somehow at a semi-conscious level, I got a sense of it as a disease thing, and that, you know, they weren't culpable for this. This was how hard their lives had been, but they were handling it better than I was, and this was important. And I was injected with some hope, really injected with it. And by the time I was ready to leave that room, I was actively fond of these old men and this environment. It was a very strange transformation. And they were very dear. They shook hands, and some of them gave me real awkward, funny hugs and gave me a lot of encouragement. One was named Pete, and he looked very elderly, but he had real twinkly blue eyes like my Grandpa Roe. And he said, Jane, you're going to have a hard time with this for a little while, he said, but tell yourself I could not drink for 5 minutes. And then tell yourself again, when 5 minutes is up, I cannot drink for 5 minutes. And he said, and then tell yourself, if that old Pete can do it, I can do it. And that stayed with me. And I had to do that. I had to do that at school the next day. I had to do that for quite a while. I don't know, maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks of 5 minutes at a time. Because every night after school, I wanted to drink. Every evening, I wanted to drink. All day I thought about it. It was just nothing else on my mind. It was hard to function. And I had active withdrawal in school, which was challenging to work. My hand shook so badly I couldn't do the card catalog. I couldn't find things. And I told everybody I'd had this really dreadful case of flu, And so I was shaky, and forgive me, but I'm not functioning very well, but I need to be here because I can't take any more sick leave. And everybody was very nice, and so I sort of functioned. But I got sober, and I fell head over heels in love with AA. And that led to falling head over heels in love with a man who looked nearly as bad as these old men, but I thought he was perfect because he represented AA to me. And that's the end of part two, because that's where I was, but I got sober.